Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Gladys Devane, Professor Emeritus at Indiana University, a very active community member, storyteller, actress, producer, writer, recipient of the Woman of Distinction Award for Advocacy, and a member of the Bloomington Playwrights Project. Gladys, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're with us today. I'm looking forward to speaking with you. And I wanted to start out, if you would, with your telling us a little bit about your experiences as an undergrad in Oklahoma in the 1960s. What were your experiences like going to school at that time as an African-American woman?
Well, first, let me say thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share some of my experiences with you. Oklahoma. In the 50s and 60s, that was a different time. I was one of the first students to integrate Oklahoma State University after our government said every state-supported school, it was unlawful to deny access. Then Oklahoma State opened up to all students, and I was one of the first. And it was quite the experience.
Gladys, did you go to a segregated elementary and middle school, or was it integrated at that point?
Yes, this was my first integrated school experience. And while I can't say that there were instances of overt discrimination, the feeling in the air was, you don't supposed to be here, and it was not as welcoming as one would like to experience as their college experience. For instance, the barbershops, the beauty shops did not serve the minority students, the African-American students. In fact, I remember going into the beauty shop wanting a haircut, and the woman said, "I'm sorry, we don't know how to do your hair." And I said, "Well, all it takes is a pair of scissors to cut it. I don't get it." So it was experiences like that that shaped my tenure at Oklahoma State University.
So where did you grow up, actually, in Oklahoma? Were you in a rural area or an urban area?
I was in Oklahoma City.
Oh, you were in Oklahoma.
Yeah, in Oklahoma City. But prior to I didn't move to Oklahoma City until I was 10 years old. I lived in Texas, a little place that's not even on the map called Sears, Texas. It's about 12 miles from Bastrop, which is about 30 miles from Austin. We lived on a 99-acre farm in which my grandfather and grandmother worked, and four of their grandchildren were there. And my first experiences, when I came to know myself as a person, I was on this farm. I hated it.
Why?
And I promised God, if he let me off that farm, I would never disturb his soil again. And I have kept that promise to God. I do not like farm work.
What did you hate about growing up there? Was it the work itself, actually?
It was, well, and I didn't, I say that tongue in cheek, my experience on the farm. It was a wonderful life. I didn't like field work. And consequently, most of the time, I didn't have to go to the fields. I stayed home with my grandmother, and she taught me to cook and clean and wash and iron and do all of those things, which I didn't mind at all. My sister, on the other hand, loved the field, and she lived for field work. But that was just not that I hated it.
So what was it like when you moved to, I'm guessing it was around the 50s that you moved to Oklahoma?
In fact, it was 1949. I moved to Oklahoma City. My grandfather died, and I moved to Oklahoma City with my mother and stepfather, whom I always refer to as my father because he behaved like my father. It was a completely different life. From dirt roads to paved streets, from amusing yourself with whatever you could find on the farm to play with, to city parks and swimming pools and those kinds of things, but still in a segregated neighborhood. So the life was very, very, very different from oil lights to electricity, mm-hmm. from a radio to the beginning of right after we moved to Oklahoma, we got our first television. So it was very different.
You attended, as you said, Oklahoma University, State University in the early 60s as one of the first blacks to integrate the university and graduated from there in the mid-60s. When did you come to Bloomington?
I came to Bloomington in 1963, right after graduating. I graduated as in speech therapy at that time. They called it speech therapy. And our organization, the National Speech and Hearing Association, at that time had just said 5 years after graduation, every speech-language pathologist would have to have a master's degree. So I decided the expedient thing to do would be to just continue right on and get my master's. So I came to Indiana University for my master's degree, had no intentions of staying here. I was offered a job after I completed my master's, and my first job was in University Elementary School.
What struck you about University Elementary School during that time?
The diversity. University Elementary School was representative of just about every culture one could imagine, and this is what was so unique about the school. And I had a wonderful principal, several wonderful principals there. The openness, the willingness to experiment with learning, the non-traditional classrooms. It was a wonderful school.
And how did you move from your position working as a speech therapist with children to eventually becoming a professor at Indiana University?
You know, all of my life, I wanted to marry a professor.
Why?
Because to me, the professors with whom I had interacted were very interesting. They were very open. They were willing to listen and entertain different ways of thinking about things. And I just thought all professors are brilliant. And I would be challenged to think differently. And so I just always wanted to marry a professor. But I married a wonderful man who isn't a professor. So I guess that's why I became one.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Gladys Devane, professor emeritus from Indiana University, actor, storyteller, and a very active community member. Gladys, tell me a little bit about, we were starting to talk about how you moved from working in the school system to actually becoming a professor at Indiana University.
I guess I always wanted to teach in a university classroom after I had gotten some exposure. See, I was the first to do a lot of things in my family. I was the first high school graduate. I was the first to go off to college. I was the first to get a master's degree.
How'd your family feel about your being this groundbreaker?
I was pushed a great deal by my parents. Education was emphasized a lot. And I was the baby, the youngest one in the family for a long, long time. And my mother had seen my oldest sister who decided she did not want that as a part of, she had seen her second child who did not go that route. And when it came to me, she pushed even harder. You must get an education. You must be able to be independent. And so this is what I wanted to do. And that route brought me to Indiana. And at a university elementary school, you're so close to the university and you're bombarded with university life and professors and thinking differently and different exposures and different experiences. And I just thought, this is something I want to do.
You know, it's interesting because we've spoken before and I've never made the connection between you and Bell Hooks, another incredible African-American woman professor, writer, and storyteller. And she spoke a lot about what it meant to leave home and gain an education and become a professor, and how that both made home so dear to her and yet difficult to go back to. Is that similar to your experience, or was yours different?
Well, difficult to go back to. I've always said you can't go home. And I think it could have been much more difficult if I had let it be. Because no matter how you look at the situation, once you have moved out of that environment and you are interacting in an environment that is so different from that in which you grew up, there will be some pulling and there will be some adjustments. Mm-hmm. I can remember going home once, and in the conversation I said something about, he handled that incorrectly. And my sister said, oh, listen to her. He handled that incorrectly. And it had never occurred to me that even the language had changed. I remember my mom saying to me, even after I had just before I graduated, after 4 years of school, mm-hmm. of college, she said, you went off to school and you have changed so much. And I thought, and I said, you know, Mom, if you sent me to school for 4 years and I came back and I hadn't changed, then what was the purpose? Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the change comes adjustments on the part of both you and the environment in which you're interacting.
Okay. When you first started teaching at Indiana University, you were teaching in the speech and hearing department, but eventually you took on some different roles and really sort of opened things up, I think, in terms of moving into cross-cultural communication as an area. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that transition and how that happened.
Quite by accident. As a speech-language pathologist in the 60s and 70s, it was during the time that we started to pay attention to communication differences, because all of a sudden now you have a number of African-Americans in the classroom now with whites, and the mode of interacting was very different. And one of the things that happened at the School of Business, that at that time was not the Kelly School of Business, they had a number of black students that would get through the curriculum there and were wonderful students. The School of Business had an interviewing process mm-hmm. at the end of their tenure to find jobs. These students would go to interviews, and they were frequently denied, were not accepted as potential employees. And the interviewer would say, you don't talk right. And the students were, they were dumbfounded. What do you mean, I don't talk right? Well, they did not use, I put in quote, the standard vernacular. So these students would come to me. I am good in accounting. My grades are wonderful. I interview well, but I don't get jobs because they tell me, quote, I don't talk right. Mm-hmm. So help me talk in a way when I interview so that I will not be denied a job. Well, not only was it talking right, it was the whole interactive process of which articulation and word choice and was a part of it.
What Gloria Ladson-Billings, another educator, I believe, calls code switching.
Code switching, absolutely, absolutely. And so no other speech pathologist at the Speech and Hearing Center would touch the young men and young women, because the take at that time, the organization said, this is not an anomaly. There is nothing wrong with this person's speech, so we won't work with them. And I thought, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. This person is telling me the way I'm using the language and my articulation is closing doors to me. I want those doors open. You know how to open those doors, but you won't help me. So I took it up on myself to begin working with these students. And I became very interested in this whole process of cross-cultural communication, the way different cultures interact differently. And so I decided I wanted to.
How do you feel about the whole notion of having to learn to code switch, having to be able to drop what would be a way that you've grown up speaking in order to adopt a more, in quotes, standard English in order to be able to make the correct impression?
I guess my take on that is we use different methods of interacting across many different situations. Even those students of, quote, standard English don't talk and interact the same way in the classroom as they do at home. They don't interact the same way on the playground as they do with their parents or, you know, with their peers. So this code switching bit is a part of life. And because I have to behave linguistically differently in a work setting, to me, is not compromising who I am. So I don't have any problems with that. I do have a problem, however, when you tell me that it's inferior, it's wrong, you should not. There's a time and place for everything, and I believe that there's a time and place for different codes, linguistic codes.
Speaking of different ways of speaking, when did you first become drawn to the whole field of storytelling?
I guess it's been a part of me since about age 9. Now, prior to that, when I said I lived in Texas, I lived with my grandfather and my great-grandfather. My grandfather built a cabin for my great-grandfather on our property. And during the winter months, we would go to my great-grandfather's cabin and gather around this pot-bellied stove, and he would spin stories, and so would my grandfather. Just unbelievable stories and just hold us spellbound. Well, I didn't realize the relevance of those stories until much, much later in life. There was always a moral to the story. It always made you think. He was a wonderful storyteller. Then when I moved to Oklahoma, I came from a very religious family. I was very good in drama, in dramatic readings. And so I used a lot of this in storytelling and Bible stories. James Weldon Johnson wrote a book entitled God's Trombones. And it's a book of seven sermons. And I learned those and gave those as dramatic readings or sermons of James Weldon Johnson. But became quite good at this and gave full-blown programs. That was my first introduction to telling stories. I told them as dramatic readings in contests at high school, throughout high school, and also as a part of my church upbringing, as my grandmother would say.
What were some of the stories that your great-grandfather and your grandfather told? What were some of the subjects of those stories that they told?
The Bruh Rabbit, Bruh Fox series.
I grew up on Bruh Rabbit.
Bruh Rabbit was always had to outsmart the fox, you know, this kind of thing. The traditional fairy tales, but with a different twist. Old Man Moses stories, and how he, you know, outfoxed the boss, you know, these kinds of things. The rabbit and the tortoise stories, those kinds of stories, always with there is a message, underlying message here that I want you to get.
Mm-hmm. How did you said you started telling stories first around Sunday school, mm-hmm, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. How did you take that into developing your own stories eventually?
Well, the first story that I wrote was a story about my grandmother, and whom I loved dearly. And as I aged, I keep thinking, my grandmother had to have a weakness somewhere, but I still haven't discovered it. To me, she was the greatest woman that ever lived. Her teaching, it's almost like a record that plays over and over and over. I can hear her take on various situations even today. And I often think of some of the things, some of her statements. For example, God first, others second, and then you. You take care of others and God will take care of you. It was this wise woman that always had a saying that could always show you the brighter side. And so my first story was a story that she told, but she didn't tell it as a story. She just told it as, this is an experience. And it made a beautiful story.
Did she move with you to Oklahoma City?
Yes. Yes.
So you grew up with her?
Yes. Yes. She lived about 4 doors from us in the same city block with her son. So, and I didn't lose my grandmother until I was 21 years old. And even at that time, it was a tremendous loss.
But you've carried her stories with you.
I've carried her stories with me.
I wanted to take the opportunity to listen to one of the pieces of music that you chose. And one of my favorite songs, I must say, Sam Cooke's Change Is Going to Come. Mm-hmm. How did you come to choose that piece?
The first time I heard that piece, I thought, he's singing about me. He's singing about experiences to which I can relate. And also, I heard in that piece one of the things that my grandmother used to say all the time, honey, change is always going on. You just wait long enough, it's gonna change. And to me, it mirrored everything that I had grown up hearing. A change is gonna come. Life may be bad today, but you just hang in there. A change is gonna come. A change is gonna come. So it was almost as if he wrote that song especially for me.
Born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. It will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long.
You're joining Profiles, and I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Our guest is Dr. Gladys Devane. Gladys, we were talking a little bit about your grandmother before we listened to Sam Cooke's song. Tell me a little bit more about the kind of role that storytelling played in your family, and then we're going to have you tell a story as well.
Okay. I guess I didn't think much about the role of storytelling until very late in life. A question that I've often asked, because I came from a very religious family, I mean, we were steeped in religion. And most of the time, every aspect of life was related in some way to, quote, the Bible. God said, do such and such. You do this because, quote, you're Christian. And so I began to ask the question, could I be a good person without being steeped in religion? And the answer to that was, My grandmother didn't do that. It was only after I left my grandmother, even though my grandmother was very religious, it was almost like good people behave in a certain way, not because God's going to get you. And listening to her and watching her interact with people and listening to my grandfather's stories, and there was always a lesson to be learned in interacting with people, I began to try to answer that question. And I think storytelling helped me come to grips with it didn't have to be, quote, steeped in religion in order to shape behavior. I think stories do a lot to shape a person's behavior.
Gladys, was storytelling one of the things that brought you into being an active member at the Bloomington Playwrights Project?
Yes. Yes. My first experience at the Bloomington Playwrights Project, I participated in one of those marathons. My first interaction was I had written a story and gave that story, and it was a story about my life on the farm with my grandparents, with my grandmother. And so that was my first experience. And it was after retirement. And I thought to myself, you really enjoy that. I was asked to star in Heat, a play put on there, BPP. And then after that, I was sort of hooked. I like this. I really do enjoy this.
And I know you have a very adamant view about retirement, which is...
which is retirement is not for one to wait, sit around and wait to die. I think it's another phase of life. It's a time to rediscover. It's a time to devote time to doing those things that you truly enjoy doing. And so this is how I'm spending my retirement.
Okay. Well, I would love to hear the story that you brought with you.
This story is entitled Growing Up, Growing Older. The first day of class, his senior year in college, his professor introduced himself and he challenged the students to get to know someone they didn't know already. Joe stood up and looked around, and a gentle hand touched his shoulder. He turned to find a wrinkled little old lady beaming up at him with a smile that lit up the whole room. "Hiya, handsome. My name is Rose. I'm 87 years old. Can I give you a hug?" Joe laughed enthusiastically. "Of course you may." And she gave him a giant squeeze. "Why are you in college at such a young age?" Joe asked. She jokingly replied, "I'm here to meet a rich husband, to get married, to have a couple of children, and then to retire and travel. Are you available?" He smiled. No, seriously. He was curious about what would motivate a woman like this to a challenge at her age. "Well, I always dreamed of having a college education. The opportunity presented itself, so here I am." Now, after class, they walked to the student union building, shared a chocolate milkshake. They became instant friends, and every day for the next 3 months, they would leave class together and talk nonstop. Joe was mesmerized listening to this time machine as she shared her wisdom. She loved to dress up, and she reveled in the attention bestowed upon her by the other students. She was living it up. At the end of the semester, Joe invited Rose to speak at their football banquet. And those students will never forget what Rose taught them. Rose was introduced. She stepped up to the podium. And as she began to deliver her prepared speech, she dropped her note cards, and they scattered all over the floor. Frustrated and a little embarrassed, she leaned into the microphone and simply said, "I'm sorry. I'm a little jittery. I gave up beer for Lent, and this whiskey is killing me. I'll never get this speech back in order, so I'll just tell you what I know." The students laughed. Rose cleared her throat and began. "We don't stop playing because we get old. We get old because we stop playing. There are only four secrets to staying young, being happy, and achieving success. One, you got to have love. I mean, love life and love living. And love makes you laugh and find humor in every day. It's love that feeds the soul. And the second, you've got to have a cause to grow. You've got to have a dream. When all your dreams die, you die. There's so many people walking around dead and they don't even know it. You've got to know the difference between growing older and growing up. If you are 19 and you lie in bed for a year and do absolutely nothing, you're going to turn 20. I'm 87. And if I sit around a year and do absolutely nothing, I'm going to turn 88. It doesn't take talent to grow older. It doesn't take creativity. It doesn't take ability. Anybody can grow older. The idea is to grow up. To grow up by finding opportunity in everything. And finally, you got to have no regrets. We elderly have no regrets for things we did. We have regrets for things we didn't do. The only people who fear dying are those who have regrets. So, have no regrets. Rose concluded her speech by courageously singing the Rose. You see, if you have a love for life and living, that covers it all. I don't think anyone can say it better than that song, The Rose. Rose challenged the students to study the lyrics of the song and to live them out in their daily lives. 1 week later, Rose died peacefully in her sleep, and over 2,000 college students attended the funeral in tribute to a wonderful woman who taught by example that it's never too late to be all that you can possibly be.
Thank you, Gladys. Where did that story come from?
Believe it or not, off the internet. So I don't know who the author is, but I got it off the... A friend sent it to me.
Thank you. You were talking a little bit about your getting involved with the Bloomington Playwrights Project and moving from a marathon event as a group to acting in production. And I know about a year ago or so, you put on a one-woman show, From the Mouth of My People, A Journey from Slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you move from acting to actually writing, producing, and putting together a one-woman show on stage.
Well, I decided that it's very difficult to find, first of all, at my age, there are very few parts. There are very few opportunities. And the things that interest me, that makes it even much more difficult. So I thought, if you want to be a part of acting, then you are going to have to guide your experiences and take them in a direction that you want them to go. And the only person who can do that is you. And so I took it upon myself to write, using some material already written, this one-person show that talked about the experience of slavery and after slavery, and showed the African American through that process.
What were the reactions that you got from people seeing you go through the different transitions as a one-woman show that you have to go through from part to part, from era to era, from voice to voice? What were some of the reactions you got?
Surprise. The first piece that I did in that show depicted a man in his 60s, and it was based on a sort of a folk tale. And this man had supposedly come over on the boat. He was actually more than 200 plus years old, because something had happened to him as the story, witchcraft, as the story was told. And the first, it was about a 40 to 45 minute story. And it started with him on the slave ship coming over and what happened on that slave ship. And then he took us to the plantation on which he was planted when he got off the ship, and his life on that plantation and some of the things that happened. And from there, his family. And I was the man in that, telling that story. He had become a lawyer. And the second story was a story of a 10-year-old talking about her experience with her sisters. And then the third story was the story that I wrote about my grandmother, and a story that she told me about her family and how her reaction to what had happened in her life. It was very well received. There was only one performance, and it was a sellout performance. In fact, I sort of regretted that I didn't do at least a couple of days, but it was a wonderful experience.
What did you discover about yourself through that experience?
I discovered that with a little help and encouragement, and the proper venue, I could make a difference in theater. I could take skills that I have, and I could polish those skills, and I could send them in, use those skills to go in different directions and explore and expand and offer the community something that I think this community needs. Experience and an opportunity to look at life through the eyes of someone else.
So what do you see as some of the things that you want to do in the future, especially with Bloomington Playwrights Project, with theater, storytelling, and your own acting?
I would like more opportunities to engage in shows like the one-person show. I certainly would like more opportunities to stage performances in which we could have a broader basis of the community. And that's what we tried to do in the One More River to Cross performance that we did not too long
ago. And we was you and Professor James Mumford.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that that production and some of the elements that you brought to that.
That was a cast of 30, and it was extremely large. Dr. Mumford had written this performance, One More River to Cross, for a groups program. And one of the projects, well, each year with each set of students, they have to do a performance. And they have to prepare and produce this performance in 4 to 6 weeks, I think it is. So he had a skeleton. This was not at all what I had intended when I said, let's do a program celebrating Black History Month. The program that I wanted to do, I wanted to work with him because I am not a singer. I am not a dancer. I am an actor and a storyteller. And so I wanted a show that used singing and dancing, and because I wanted to focus on African Americans in entertainment and do a history of this. And I thought he would be the ideal person because he is incredibly good. But he convinced me that we didn't have the time to do this. This was a long-term project. So I took his skeleton, which was very, the idea was there, using portraits and having that portrait come to life and tell a story. Or I took that and I put, rather than talk about, I put the words in the mouths of the characters. So I wrote stories for the characters that we used in that performance. And we went again from the boat, from slavery, with a slave talking about his experiences coming over, to life on the plantation, to the various entertainers, up to the civil rights movement.
I know that, I can't remember in one interview I was looking at that you did, you made the statement, I believe the arts can and should be used as a medium to bridge the gaps between different realities, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spoken a little bit about that. Can you speak a little bit more about how you see that happening and what are the elements that are necessary to make that happen?
I think listening and communicating. We come from very different realities. In fact, I talk about growing up with my sisters. And I listen to them talk about home life. And I think, were we in the same house? I don't remember that being that way at all. And I walked away with a very different reality. And I think to myself, if this can happen so much, if two people from identical environments can come away with completely different takes on that environment, how much more so is this the case when we're coming from two different environments and we're thrown together? We have very different realities. And one of the ways, I think, to bridge the gap between those realities is to do it in the theater. It allows the person, all people involved, to sit back and digest. And think about what I'm seeing here, what I'm hearing here, and ideally to be able to talk about it so that you can sort of come to a better understanding of what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking and how I got there. And I can come to a better understanding about why or how you could view the world differently, why you don't see the world the way I see it. One of the most interesting things to me is to ask an African-American, are there any race problems in Bloomington? And then ask a white, are there any race problems in Bloomington? Two completely different answers, two different realities. And I think we need to use art and the medium of art to try to bridge that gap.
There's a phrase that was coined by Glenn Singleton, another educator that I know, called courageous conversations, conversations especially about race and about equity and social justice. How do you get – talk to me a little bit. You brought it up about how you get these conversations going and – in a way that's meaningful and in a way that can act as a generative to change.
sometimes it's very difficult because everyone's walking on pins and needles. And I think if the people engaged in the conversation can go into that conversation knowing that something may be said that you may not agree with or that you may take differently, but can we continue the dialogue? Can you make me understand why you're feeling this? Can we talk about this without becoming defensive? A good example, a dear, dear friend of mine, and we have been friends for years, had just completed reading a book. I don't remember the exact title of the book, but she said to me, and she was very serious, "Gladys, why do black men beat their wives?" I said to myself, count to 10 before you answer that question, because the automatic response is to immediately get angry. Mm-hmm. How could you say a thing like that? But first of all, I thought, okay, that has to be coming from somewhere. So we need to talk about how she got to this point. So I said to her, how many black men do you know? And she began to rattle off. And she named 5, 6, 7. I said, how many of them beat their wives? Oh, none that I know of. I said, do you realize what you just said to me? Why do black men beat their wives, beat their girlfriend? She said, that's not what I meant. So it's that kind of, then let's talk about what you meant. What really did you mean? Well, she had read this story in which the villain was a black man who was violent, and he had violent tendencies. And, well, isn't this a part of a lot of ethnic groups? This is not, yeah, it is, but at the moment, I was not thinking in those terms. So this is one instance of what I mean by keeping the dialogue open rather than, how dare you make a statement like that? Mm-hmm. You've got to talk about it. And I'm sure I've said some things that's stupid, too.
One of the reasons that you've said that you're so involved in community theater is to be able to bring about meaningful dialogue between people who do things in different ways and see things in different ways. And you talked about theater letting people sort of step back and watch things. Mm-hmm. As a board member and as an actor, what do you see as your responsibility of what else you want to bring to the stage and to the dialogues that follow that?
I see especially Bloomington Playwrights Project on the cutting edge of presenting material that otherwise would not have a venue in which to be presented. And I think that we need to continue to do that, and we need to expand it. We have all different ethnic groups. We have all different lifestyles. And I think that every opportunity that we get to expose the community to those different lifestyles, to those different ethnicities, to different ways of viewing the world, we should be pushing. We should be pushing the theater to do that, or we should be pushing art to do that.
Gladys, it has been a pleasure to have this time to speak with you.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure to have the opportunity to participate.
You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Gladys Devane. We are going to listen to one last song that you mentioned in your story, The Rose by Bette Midler. Was that a song that was important to you before you ever read the story?
Yes. Yes. And then I had the job to go find the story, so that part of that performance is Rose, the person in the story, singing the rose, which is a whole nother take.
Some say love, it is a river.
that drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love,
the program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.